2006-31130, United States of America versus Monica D. Tatum McWilliams. Mr. Bertucci, you may proceed.
May it please the court, my name is Anthony Bertucci. I'm co-counsel of Ms. McWilliams. Lead counsel is Nathan Fisher. He was on the brief. Your Honor, I'm going to focus this morning on ineffective assistance of counsel. Now, I know that's very unusual to talk to an appellate court about ineffective assistance of counsel because there's no record. You just have the face of the record. But I think that I'm going to be able to show this court on the face of the record that there was ineffective assistance of counsel. Briefly, let me tell you about this trial. It was a 47-count indictment. And what it alleged was that this lady had stolen from a daycare center and also from a food program, both of them under the federal government. And it also involved a system whereby she had forged vouchers. There was one other co-conspirator. The loss was approximately $600,000. There were 48 witnesses, approximately 9 for the defense. There were over 250 exhibits. They had both federal and state agents testify as to these different programs. The trial lasted 6 days, and unfortunately, the defendant took the stand and testified on her behalf and was found, she got 2 points for obstruction of justice on 6 counts of perjury that the probation office recognized, not the judge. And once they were presented to the judge said, sure. He says, I saw the case, I saw the record. Yes. And what it boils down to, Your Honor, is this young lawyer named Scott had 33 days to prepare for this case. The indictment was on December 5th. Ms. McWilliams had a lawyer on January 5th. That lawyer withdrew March 28th.
Didn't she discharge that lawyer?
I don't know the answer to that. I was looking for that record. I talked to the lawyer, so I don't want to mix up the record with what I heard from the lawyer.
Doesn't that matter? Because
yes, it does.
Okay.
But I think if you review his motion, and I have not, that his bar roll number is very high. He was very new, and one of the reasons.
The original lawyer.
Correct. Again, I didn't read. I didn't read the motions.
I thought the record said she discharged him because she wanted to represent herself.
No, she. What had happened is she had a show cause to get a lawyer. So at the show cause hearing, she told the magistrate, I'm going to represent myself. And the magistrate appointed a public defender with standby counsel. So, and that happened on the 27th of April because the hearing was on May 2nd. And she was put in jail on May 15th. Her bond was revoked. And that's important because counsel comes on board May 18th of 06. Remember, the trial is 6/21. 06. It's 33 days away, and I could just hear him. The judge said,
"Be clear. Do you say that the counsel she had was standby counsel only throughout the proceeding?"
Or, no, ma'am. I'm sorry, sir. No.
At some point, they took over and became the.
That's
lawyer.
Correct.
Okay.
Where the standby counsel came up is there was a show cause why she hadn't had a lawyer. She goes to court before the magistrate to show cause. Ms. McWilliams says, I want to represent myself, and then the judge appoints the public defender standby for that hearing. And you'll notice the docket. The public defender withdraws right before the trial.
Let me ask you something before we get too much further afield on this question, Mr. Bertucci. If we determine that, we shouldn't hear this because it's not well enough developed, that doesn't bar a subsequent habeas. But if we were to reach this on the merits and say, no, Mr. Scott was plenty effective, then doesn't that preclude a further argument?
Listen,
to reach this? Because your own brief, or maybe you didn't write it, but you're now arguing on it, says that it would require this court to review evidence outside the record on appeal. And so you're asking us, in a sense, on a limited record, to say, well, this guy seemed a little unprepared, a little flustered, and therefore we're going to find ineffective. And we say, well, you know what? A lot of lawyers are flustered and sort of confused looking, and that's not enough. Is that really the result you want?
I mean,
aren't
you
playing high stakes game here?
It's like you tell me I'm putting all my eggs in one basket.
Well, I'm just questioning, this is the point that you want to make in your 20 minutes that you have with the Fifth Circuit.
Yes, it is.
When this is the point that is best left for habeas of all the points that you've got.
Well, frankly, the other issues that were brought up in the appeal relate to ineffective assistance of counsel, and they're not strong arguments, Your Honor. But I think the ineffective assistance of counsel is clearly a strong argument.
So you think on this record we can just say this guy seemed a little confused and that's good enough?
Yeah, but it's not confused.
You know, the burden's pretty high on
ineffective. Yes, it is. Oh, Strickland is very high. But what happened is on May 18th, he gets there. He tells the judge, I can do it. Well, on June 9th, he files an amended motion for a continuance. And he says, and it's I don't know what docket number it is in the record, but he basically says it's not possible to prepare this case.
Doesn't every lawyer say that in a motion for continuance, and then it's denied, and they go to trial and do just fine? I mean, I have yet to see a motion for continuance say, Judge, I'm fully prepared, I'd love to be there, unless it's based on some sudden conflict like a death in the family.
That's correct.
But half the motions for continuance filed are, I've got this and that to do, and I'm busy, and I haven't done this discovery, or I haven't gotten this piece of evidence, or I haven't interviewed this witness. And then you say, well, we're ready, let's go. And they come in and they do the case, and those thousands of lawyers aren't all ineffective.
Not to disagree with the court, but in the Middle District where I practice, if a lawyer filed this motion, he would get a continuance, because the court would believe him. If the court believes this motion, if the court believes those facts are correct, they've got to give him a continuance. I mean, he says paragraph after paragraph after paragraph, it's impossible. And by the way, he has a basis. He gets delivered right 2 weeks before the trial, he gets seven boxes of records.
Okay, but this goes back to whether it was she who discharged the prior guy or not. And my understanding from the materials I reviewed is that she did, in fact, say she didn't want to continue. She wanted to represent herself. She wanted the option of getting a lawyer. And when the client's the one who creates the problem, is it the same analysis?
No, but I don't know if I can agree with those facts. The way I understand the facts is where it was brought up, the lawyer, Kevin Johnson, withdrew on March 28th. There was a show cause hearing on May 2nd, and it's at that point she says she wants to represent herself.
Yeah, she was ordered to retain counsel by April 26th.
Correct.
Did she do that?
No, she did not, Your Honor.
Okay.
She did not, and she went to jail for it. But what I'm saying is, I don't know, I don't think the record reflects that she fired Kevin Johnson. I believe, and I'm not sure about this, Your Honor, but I believe Kevin Johnson withdrew because of experience.
Yeah, Counsel, you don't just have this motion that he says he's not prepared. You have the judge saying that the counsel's ill-prepared in the record, talking about how ill-prepared this lawyer is, don't you?
The first day of trial, the judge says, and it's on page 197 of the trial transcript, the judge says, one thing we're running into here, when you took this case, that Mr. Scott, you said you could handle the case, yet you have just time after time asked for delays. You've asked to file motions untimely. And the judge goes on and on, and at one point says, you're not doing what you said you would do and agreed to do. And what he said he would do is I can do the case, Your Honor. I want the case, May 18th. I can do it. He couldn't do it. This was a paper case. This is massive amounts of paper.
But the standard isn't, there's always, look, anytime you go to trial as a lawyer, there's always something you go, boy, I wish I'd done that. You know, there's always something you could have done more. So the standard isn't, could he have done more? And the standard isn't, did he have a lot of papers to read? The standard is whether he made errors so serious that counsel was not functioning as the counsel guaranteed by the Sixth Amendment. Again, it's a pretty high standard for the reason that we don't want Monday morning quarterbacking on every single lawyer in town.
I'm very familiar with that. And by the way, I understand the standard's high, and I believe it's made. Let me give you examples on the record. He, as a trial attorney, put his client, remember, he says, I'm unprepared. He puts his client on the stand, and his client is found guilty of perjury on six occasions? Now, surely, I've never been in that situation. Surely, when he talked to her, when he would brief her, when he would go over the documents, he would determine how she would testify.
Isn't that what we need to develop? Was this lady insisting on testifying, and he's saying, no, 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 and she insists anyway, and he goes over this stuff, and how many clients have you had that, they don't always testify as you thought they might, and they don't always testify consistently with documents you've gone over with them, and that's just life. So
yes,
I
it
guess,
is.
Isn't that the very development we need to see here
well,
of the facts?
You see, I don't think that happened, because if, in fact, she got on the stand and committed perjury and the attorney knew it, well, he was in a Nix versus Whiteside situation. So he'd have to approach the court and say, Judge,
well,
look what's
happening. I'm talking about what you're saying. Whether, I mean, there's a question whether she should have testified at all. And we don't know the substance of all the decisions that were made, how surprised he was by something she said, how much he went over something, and then she suddenly says something else. I mean, we don't know all of
we
that.
Don't.
And isn't that what we should have developed before we decide this on the merits?
Yes, I'd like to develop that, but I can tell the court this, that on June 9th, he said, I don't have the records, I haven't interviewed the witnesses to be prepared for this. So he's stating that, and we see what happens when the trial starts. That is, he puts her on the stand. I'll tell you something else he didn't have time to prepare. He didn't have time to prepare a decision whether she could make a plea or not. Do you realize that there was a 5-point swing when she went to trial? She lost the 3 points for acceptance of responsibility, got 2 points for obstruction of justice. Her guidelines would have been 22 instead of 27. She'd have been at 41 months instead of 87 months. And just looking at that mere fact, there was a question that I believe his motion to continue. I believe if you believe this motion to continue, he's ineffective. He's saying he can't do it. It's clear. And sure, I'd like to give you more facts. But these are the facts I have. And as a lawyer, I believe these facts are strong. I mean, I could remember this admonition. The kid says on May 18th, I can do it, Judge. And then on June 21st, the day of the trial, about 100 pages into the trial, he panics. And, I mean, evidently, the judge admonishes him, saying, you're not playing by the rules. You know, this is federal court. You have to learn how to play by the rules. And the rules, he wasn't prepared, and he didn't figure out how to really impress the court with the fact of how unprepared he was, or he decided to give up and go to trial. Now, in fact, Your Honor, it's interesting. You can't tell anything about credibility from a transcript, of course. But if you read that cold transcript, and if you read her testimony, that is McWilliams' testimony, it's chilling. It's chilling in the fact that, you know, you would say, well, why did she take the stand? What possessed her to do this? On the face. I'm not talking about credibility, but on the face.
We all know there are clients who, against the best advice of their attorney, get up, civil and criminal, get up and testify and do a horrible job of it. That by itself, without more development. And I'm not saying this ultimately isn't an ineffective claim. My concern is whether we handle it now or we address it, or we let a trial court down the road address it on a greater record.
Candidly, I think Judge, judicial efficiency, you can look at this and say, look, I believe on the face of this, this is close. And surely these other facts will be developed, or a couple of other facts. But again, I feel confident in telling this court that
Mr. Bertucci,
yes,
think
sir.
We have that argument. Is that your only argument you want to make to us?
Basically, yes, and I'll tell you why. Because there were three other arguments made. One was about the statements the prosecutor made.
It's your time.
Right.
You've only got a minute and
50 I'll tell you about. Thank you, Your Honor. The statements the prosecutor made. She said something about a conspiracy. So, you know, the government must have been in a conspiracy, and the state must be in a conspiracy to find this lady guilty. Well, there was no objection, and the problem with that is for the jury to find the person now not guilty, they'd have to figure out that the government formed a conspiracy. But there's a problem. First problem is, she opened up the door. I mean, I'm arguing against it. She, McCormick, McWilliams, opened up the door at trial. And the reason I say that falls over to ineffective is, she wasn't advised. She wasn't advised. She should have never taken the stand. And I think that's obvious from the front of the record. It's obvious from the amount of the evidence, the documents that were placed into the record, which showed forgeries.
Does her testimony alone establish your prejudice prong?
No. No. I think that's just part of it. Again, I would refer the court to revisit the amended motion to continue on June 9th. He filed another motion around that time, and he got a 2-day continuance. I never understood what that was about. But I know this, that if you accept this amended motion to continue, and if he's being, you know, a lawyer is an officer of the court. He, you know, if the judge thought that this was in any way exaggerated, he should have asked him. This was a serious motion. So that, Your Honor, you'd have to look at that with the other facts. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Ms. Cassier.
Briefly, with respect to the ineffective assistance of counsel claim, this particular attorney is not an inexperienced attorney. He has tried many cases in federal district court and in state district court, some of them successfully defending clients and had.
What about the time issue? Is 33 days long enough to get ready for what, you know, what is a fairly complex case? This isn't just, you know, did she hold up a bank or not? This is all these documents that are going to show that whether some kid was there or not and so on.
That is correct, Your Honor. And this attorney was successful in having his client released from jail. Her bond had been revoked and she was in jail. He had her released from jail so that she could work with him on preparing the defense during this time. I believe she was released, I want to say it's something like May, it was the end of May, sometime around 23rd or 26th. So she was released from custody to assist him, and he assured the court at some point that this was all the time.
Well,
that he
Mr. Bertucci is saying that by itself shows ineffectiveness because he didn't seek more time sufficiently, or that he didn't like maybe mean this motion for continuance enough, or he misjudged his own ability to get ready, or whatever.
I think then you need to look at the actual trial. This defense attorney vigorously cross-examined all the government witnesses. His cross-examination was extensive for all of them. He developed a theory of the case, which he began at his opening.
That everybody was setting
in
her
his
up.
Opening statement. He knew where he was going.
Counsel, the difficulty with your argument is that you have to generate impressions about what happened and what the lawyer was doing, their tactical strategies, etc. Strickland cannot be resolved on direct appeal in this case. That's just self-evident. It's going to have to go to 2255, and we're just wasting time.
I agree with you, Judge.
Unless you think differently.
I don't think differently. I do agree.
Argue, but cannot resolve this. Your argument immediately goes right outside the record to talk about the tactical moves. In a 2255, the lawyer is going to have to explain their deficiencies or not, and you'll be able to develop the record and make the judgment of Strickland prong number two as to whether it's the prejudicial impact. That's why, you know, it's just very, very difficult to even talk about these things. I appreciate counsel's argument. It's a good advocate move to argue, and I understand the lawyer was bumbling through the trial. It does perhaps give context to the other claims that are there, but as an independent basis of recovery, at this juncture, that's all I'm saying.
I agree with you, Your Honor, that this should be reserved for a 2255 and for decision on that basis. But just looking at the record as a whole, there is no ineffective assistance shown on the record as it exists.
Counsel, you filed something at some point in this case that said that 2255 review was precluded because of the timing of this whole situation. Do you recognize now that the conviction is not final because the appeal's been reinstated and 2255 review is not precluded in this matter?
My motion to dismiss was to dismiss the appeal,
but since
not
the appeal
to dismiss the 2255. I recognize that. What I'm saying in my motion to dismiss is that this appeal was reinstated over a year after it was dismissed. It was dismissed on December 11th. Of 2006, 2005, I've gotten my time limits off, but it was a year and 34 days before it was reinstated. And under the court's,
didn't have the authority to do that?
Under the court's own rules, Rule 45, the court may reinstate within 180 days, and then there's an additional discretionary period of an additional 180 days. This is outside of that.
So you're saying we lack jurisdiction?
So I'm saying that under Plasencia and the footnote 17 in Plasencia and under the logic of Plasencia, that if the defendant could not have raised a 2255 on January 15th when he filed his motion to reinstate the appeal. And he could not have raised a 2255 at that point because the appeal had been dismissed for over a year.
Well, I don't want to decide whether a 2255 is timely at this point. I want to get back to just one question that Judge Higginbotham makes an excellent point about whether this is the time to do it. But I do have one question on that, which is whether Ms. McWilliams testifying or not testifying was the subject of any discussion in the trial court. Was there, sometimes they go outside the presence of the jury and the counsel puts her on the stand and says, do you understand that you don't have to testify, so on and so forth. Did that occur here?
No, Your Honor.
Okay.
Well, counsel, I'm sorry. It seemed to me that you just agreed with Judge Higginbotham that this case was better suited for 2255.
On the ineffectiveness claim.
And I'm trying to, but have you taken the position in this court already that 2255 is already ready precluded, such that your agreement with Judge Higginbotham is, while it may be better suited for it, you're certainly not saying that you're agreeing that it could proceed?
Your Honor, if this court accepts that the appeal was timely reinstated and that this court has jurisdiction and authority to take the appeal a year and 34 days after it was dismissed.
Well, you're here, aren't you?
I am here. That is correct, Your Honor. Then in that instance, the 2255 would, the year time would begin running from the date that this appeal is final, this judgment of this case is final. What I argued in my motion to dismiss was simply that there's a question as to whether the court had authority to reinstate an appeal a year and 34 days after it was finally dismissed.
Okay. Thank you.
That's my question. With respect to any of the other issues, does the court have any questions on any of the other issues that are raised, the sentencing issues or the obstruction of justice?
Well, if we didn't have authority to reinstate it on appeal, and you're persuading the Supremes of that, he can't raise it on direct appeal either.
I'm sorry, I missed your comment.
If direct appeal is untimely and therefore somehow the 2255 is untimely, neither place is an avenue for Ms. McWilliams.
That may be correct.
And so if it be timely reinstated, though, rule on the merits of everything other than ineffective, then they would have a timely 2255 at that point.
That is correct.
I think that's what Judge Higginbotham's asking.
That is correct. Any other questions, Your Honor? Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I'll briefly address, if it's necessary, her motion to dismiss and the case she cited, Palencia. Palencia was decided on a person who filed a 2255. And what the court ruled was that the ruling was about when the time starts running, that year starts running. And he did not file a direct appeal. Therefore, the court said, well, since he didn't file a direct appeal, we'll give him 10 days from the conviction, and that's when the 1 year starts running. So it was a very limited decision. It
doesn't have anything to do with
this. Yeah, I mean, this is a direct appeal that had been dismissed for, seems like, clerical errors, and was reinstated, by the way, by this court the next day. I guess I was troublesome with Judge Higginbotham says, and I understand this, that I'm early on doing this. And I've gone through the record, I've talked to other lawyers, and I said, maybe I'm not being objective. I'm not real objective sometimes when it comes to ineffectiveness, okay?
You're a good advocate, and you're entitled to argue that. I'm just giving you straight from the shoulder.
Oh, sure. And I'm trying to convince you, Judge. I'm trying to say, you know, I guess what I'm trying to say, too, is that courts are rarely faced with this difficult question on an appeal. You know, you get it in a habeas, and you get all the documents. You know, you get the lawyers testified and whatever evidence is produced. But what I'm saying here is that if you look at the record, and you have to revisit the record, if you revisit the record in light of his amended motion to continue, I think it proves it. I mean, he was saying things like paragraph 11. He said, since counsel was retained, have made a diligent effort to prepare for trial, it is simply not possible to prepare under these circumstances. You know, she brought up the woman that the McWilliams went to jail. But interestingly, what happened with that is this. The lawyer entered as a counsel of record 518. She was not released from jail until June 7th. He, Scott, puts in his motion, he's saying, look, I've got to get this person because the jail is miles away. There's only 12 hours to visit her. You know, I have to make time to visit her. I can't bring the documents, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So he was saying, I'm without my client to go through these. So when he does get the client back, he's got 2 weeks to prepare, and he filed the June 9th motion. So, I guess when you're reviewing a record, I don't know if you're going to go look at a motion, a amended motion to continue, and you know, and read it. Since I, of course, am the counsel, I went all this, you know, went through this carefully, and again, I feel that their facts.
I don't think per se a very gut-wrenching motion to continue proves ineffectiveness when it's denied, because I've seen a lot of gut-wrenching motions for continuance that were filed by lawyers who did a perfectly fine job at trial. So again, I'm not suggesting that they're lying or anything like that, but I'm just saying that they kind of see the world through their eyes as they file the motion, and when it's denied, they nevertheless perhaps sometimes do an ineffective job, but sometimes do an effective job. I just can't say as a matter of law that a gut-wrenching motion for continuance means the counsel was ineffective.
I agree 100%. But the difference is, in this motion, he talks about the reasons he's not unprepared, and they're correct. And that is, there's a massive amount of documents. I just got my client out of jail. I have 2 weeks to prepare this. I have to go through all these. I have to go and figure out how many witnesses to subpoena, what to ask them. So the point is, he had a basis for saying this. You know, it wasn't the lawyer who says, you know, we can always be more prepared. We always need more time. No, I hope that I did not lose my objectivity getting into this, but I have run this by other people to make sure that I would not bring up, which is an unusual argument, of course, is saying, I want you all to look at ineffectiveness on a cold, straight appeal. I think it exists. Judge Higginbotham, any questions, sir?
No, I appreciate your argument.
Okay. I thank you all for your patience. Thank you.
Thank you. This case is submitted.